said, which one? I usually try and keep this area clear just so it's less distracting, but that peep is kind of cute, so if it doesn't annoy you, maybe I'll leave it there. Okay, good. Kind of made my day. Good morning. Today is May the 4th. Today is May the 4th be with you day, Star Wars Day. Woohoo! So anyway, more importantly, welcome. Good to have you here. What we're going to do is continue on talking about the equilibrium with solubility, KSP. At the end, I'll return your midterms. Absolutely. Any questions before we get into it? On Wednesday, we left off with this example of a mercury chloride compound. And this is an example of a KSP. It's a type of an equilibrium constant K. It's the product of solubilities. These are called solubility product constants. But what you need to know is that the solid is always the reactant, and the ions that go into it are always the product. So in an equilibrium expression, you don't include solids and liquids. Equilibrium expressions are always products over reactants, nothing in the denominator, and the numerator here would be the mercury ion times the chloride squared. And this number is one of these K values which has been studied quite a bit. And this K number is quite a bit less than 1. Does that mean at equilibrium we will have more of the dissolved ions or more of the solid? Solid, that's right. K is less than 1, reactant favored. K is larger than 1, product favored. So these K's are usually quite a bit less than 1. That means you're going to have a lot of solids. We would call this an insoluble compound in water because we see quite a bit of solid appear pretty readily. This example that we went through on Wednesday, we have a mercury ion concentration of 0.010. And if you're curious how much chloride it takes to begin the precipitation, you can use this KSP number equals mercury times chloride. Literally place that number in there and solve for chloride. So chloride would be the square root of KSP over 0.010. It takes only 10 to the minus 8th molar chloride to begin making the solid. And this number is important to chemists because in theory, if you're at 0.9 times 10 to the minus 8th, just a little bit less than that, you won't see any solid. But when you get to 1.0 or even 1.01, just a little bit larger than that, that's when the solid begins to appear. The precipitate is visible. The next thing we did on Wednesday is we were curious how much of the mercury was left when we raised the chloride now to 1 molar. And in this example, mercury was at 0.010. We're adding a lot of chloride, all right? And by Le Chatelier's principle and all these kind of things, you add a product, the reaction will shift to the reactant side. So we should see the mercury ion concentration go down, because as chloride is added, it will react with the mercury in the solution. It'll make more precipitate. We expect this number to be less. And it's not too hard to figure out. Again, KSP equals mercury times chloride squared. In this case now, we're solving for the new mercury concentration. So the KSP divided by the chloride ion squared, which is really just 1.1 times 10 to the minus 18th, the value of the KSP, that says that our chloride has went from 0.01, or 10 to the minus 2, down to a 10 to the minus 18th. And the last thing we talked about real fast on Wednesday that I want to hit here is that in chemistry, you almost never completely get rid of something, all right? Like, you can never really get all of the mercury out. Now, most of the time, the concentrations will be so small, like in this case, 10 to the minus 18th, that is inconsequential, all right? But then we also talked about how there's like controversy. Would you happily, you know, start drinking water that had up to the supposed legal federal limit now of 50 parts per million arsenic, all right? And arsenic's really bad. It used to be 10. Some people feel it's safe to be 50. These are questions that you should think about as a person as well as a scientist, all right? By equilibrium, it's almost impossible to make anything go to zero. We saw something like this kind of with half-life in Chem 222. Like the concentration of some reactant will go down, 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 but it never really goes to zero, or at least not appreciably. This is the same kind of phenomena. And so you have to think, like I said, with your science hat on, but also as your human being side on, like, is this a safe thing? Is it not enough to make a difference? I would argue as a scientist that 10 to the minus 18th molar anything isn't going to do anything. But again, as a person, I might be a little bit more nervous about that. So, any questions on that? Okay. So here's an example of the kind of problems you might see, and they're pretty chill. Always the KSP, remember, is based on a kind of a reaction where you have the solid as a reactant, and the products are the ions. So in this case, the ions are the strontium 2 plus and the carbonate. So this number, KSP, equals the strontium ion times the carbonate ion. And it says, what concentration of carbonate do you need to begin precipitation the solid if we have this much strontium? And it gives a KSP. So the punchline here is that this number equals strontium times carbonate. And we have strontium, we don't have carbonate, so you want to solve for carbonate. The answer here will be this number divided by 0.05. And when you figure that number out, it comes out to be 1.1 times 10 to the minus 8. So again, mathematically, KSP equals strontium times carbonate. So if you want to solve for just the carbonate, that's how you would do it. And this number, this 10 to the minus 8, means that if you go past that number, you will start to see solid strontium carbonate. But if you are under this number, you shouldn't see anything. It'll look like a clear water solution or something like that. Any questions? Now, the common ion effect is thrown a lot in these kind of distinctions, and it's really nothing more than Le Chatelier's principle when all is said and done. But it's trying to justify like how you can get rid of one ion, all right? And in this world, getting rid of an ion usually means that you're making more of a solid. And why that's relevant in science is that it's pretty easy if you have a solid. You can like filter it using filter paper, or you can decant, which means to pour the liquid off the solid. Solids are fairly easy to get rid of from liquids. You can separate them out. You could even, well, you wouldn't want to, but you could evaporate the water, although that wouldn't be as helpful. So imagine that for some reason in this problem, we're trying to get rid of some silver, all right? And you can see up here, this is a silver acetate solution. This is the acetate ion, and this is the silver ion. Now, because there's some solid here, and this is a representation of those ion lattices we saw in Chem 222, which you don't need to worry about, we would see some solid. That's what this looks like on the outside. This part right here is this part. It's the alternating silver, acetates, et cetera, et cetera. But because this is equilibrium, you will have some free-floating silver ions and acetate ions. So in this problem, I guess we're trying to get rid of acetate. I said the wrong thing, not the silver, my apologies. In this problem, pretend we're trying to get rid of acetate, which is not really that bad in my opinion, but let's say we wanted to. One way to do that would be to add a lot of silver nitrate. So notice that silver was already present in the solution, but nitrate was not, all right? And the reason we do that is because over here we have an equilibrium between the solid silver acetate, and on the product side, you would write silver ions and acetate ions. if you start blasting the solution out with silver nitrate, the nitrate's not really a player, but the silver will push the reaction onto the other side. Ag, I'm just going to write it acetate because I'm lazy. This is the silver acetate that's a solid, and it's in equilibrium with silver ions and the acetate ions. This is the equilibrium on the left side. If you start adding a lot of silver, you're adding a lot of product. And this is going to make this reaction, by Le Chatelier's principle, shift to the left. As silver pushes this reaction to the left, the acetate now will go down. You will have less acetate than you had before. So the common ion effect means that you're adding an ion common to a pre-existing equilibrium. So in this case, it's the silver, which is part of it. We're adding it as silver nitrate, not as silver acetate, because apparently we want to get rid of the acetate. So notice here in this thing on the right then, there's more silver acetate, like another level, all right, than there was before. And while there were three or so acetates, there's only one acetate left. That's trying to show the acetate has gone down. But in the process of making the acetate go down, now we have nitrate around. So this common ion effect is really interesting. If you really don't want an ion, acetate in this example, mercury in the last example, whatever, you can add the appropriate ion and you can make its concentration go down. So by adding silver, reaction shifted to the left, the acetate ion went down. However, can't get something for nothing. By adding silver nitrate, now you're adding in a new ion, nitrate. And hopefully nitrate is benign, not as crazy, but you do have to add something else to get into it. And so philosophically and scientifically, this can have implications. So the common ion effect is really nothing more than Le Chatelier's principle. And it's a way to lower what is hopefully an undesirable ion. It can be positive or negative. But in the process, you do have to replace it, basically, with something else. Questions on that?
In the test tube is a solution containing lead ions. To this we add a solution containing chloride ions, and lead chloride precipitates. Solid lead chloride is in equilibrium with lead ions and chloride ions in solution. At this point, we add more chloride ions in the form of a sodium chloride solution, which disturbs the equilibrium. More lead chloride precipitates, which removes still more lead ions from solution.
In the 70s, they removed lead from paint. Apparently the kids would suck on it. It was kind of sweet tasting, I don't know. But anyway, lead's not really always the best thing to have around. But anyway, so let's say that in this example, we have a lead chloride, lead 2 chloride compound. The white solid, this is actually the same stuff that you guys saw in the Le Chatelier's principle lab in part A. You added HCl, I think it was, to PbNO3. But anyway, we want to get rid of the free lead in the solution. And so what we're doing is we're adding chloride. So this kind of yellow line here represents the initial concentration of lead. And as you add chloride, the lead will go down. So adding chloride by Le Chatelier's principle pushes this reaction to the reactant side. You'll have less lead as it makes the lead 2 chloride. And up here you can see how this PbCl2 mass is increasing. And if you really don't want to have free lead running around, you can add even a second aliquot or a second sample of chloride. All right, it'll make your lead ion concentration go down and more PbCl2 solid will appear. And again, you can filter this out, et cetera, et cetera. However, by getting rid of the lead, the chloride concentration increases. So you always have to think about what you're adding, and hopefully it's better than what you have already. This is the idea behind a common ion reaction. Barium sulfate is an example of a compound which is very insoluble in water. In Chem 221, barium sulfate was always one that was insoluble. However, it also has a KSP, an equilibrium value. And so that means that it's very, very small, but you will have measurable amounts of the BASO4, which has dissociated. So this number, because it's basically not zero, means that you will have some BASO4 breaking up, but it's very, very small. This is a very reactive favorite K. So again, if K was zero, that would mean you'd have only the solid and no ions. And I have never seen a K of zero, so I don't think that's even possible, but in this case, it certainly is not zero, so that means you'll have some ions running. So in this problem, what we want to do is first calculate the solubility of the barium sulfate in pure water, and then also calculate how soluble it is in the presence of barium sulfate. So this first part, excuse me, is just kind of like what we talked about on Wednesday. For every mole of barium sulfate that breaks up, you'll have X moles of barium and X moles of sulfate. So imagine we started with 0.1 moles of barium sulfate that we're breaking up. We would then have 0.1 moles of barium ion and 0.1 moles of sulfate. So in this case, we'll let solubility, how much it dissolves, just equal X. KSP will equal barium times sulfate, or X times X, X squared. And if you want to calculate what the solubility is, you would take the square root of that K, 1.0 times 10 to the minus 5 moles per liter. So even though barium sulfate is insoluble, all right, you do have some of it breaking up. It's pretty small, all right, 10 to the minus 5 isn't exactly large concentrations. In lab, we usually used 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2, something like that. So 10 to the minus 5 is pretty small. This is an example of a 1-to-1 ratio of cation and anion. Any questions on that? Okay. Now, in pure water, barium sulfate breaks up to the tune of 1.0 times 10 to the minus 5 moles per liter. So if you had 2 liters with barium sulfate, you'd have twice that number, et cetera, of moles, et cetera. But what we're going to do now is think about what's happening when barium is already present. So we're going to imagine taking some solid barium sulfate, which you can buy, and we're going to place it in a 0.010 molar solution of barium nitrate. Now, the nitrate really doesn't bother us too much. It's the barium we're after. And if you think about this as an equilibrium, with barium sulfate as this reactant and then ions as products, it's like all of a sudden you're adding a lot of barium, all right? And by this reaction, if you add a lot of barium, will that move the reaction more to the reactant side or more to the product side? Reactive, that's right. Adding a product, the barium from barium nitrate, is going to force all of this to go to the reactant side. And if it goes to the reactant side, we're going to predict that the solubility of the barium sulfate in the barium will be less because we're moving it to the reactant side. So in this problem, using the idea of common ion, the common ion is the barium. We're thinking about this as a barium sulfate KSP equilibrium. Barium sulfate is the reactant, and barium ions and sulfate ions as products. If we add an ion common to this equilibrium, which is where the barium from barium nitrate comes, the barium, we're adding a product, the reaction will shift to the reactant side. And this is, again, good old Le Chatelier's, all right? Anytime you add something, it'll shift to the other side. Adding the barium should move it to the reactant side. And if that's the case, you should have less barium sulfate breaking down than you had up here. In pure water, it was already small. We will hopefully calculate now a number which is like even smaller than it was before. So if barium sulfate is something to avoid, in your water, then you might want to add some barium. It'll lower these concentrations down. Questions? So to figure this out, what you can do is set it up as an equilibrium, all right? And there's different ways to do this. We're starting now with a non-zero amount of barium. It's 0.010, but we don't have any sulfate in the barium nitrate. As we place the solid barium sulfate in solution, the barium sulfate will dissociate. And I called it Y, you can call it X or theta for all I care. Any kind of variable just to represent like how it's going to break up. And for one mole of this, you'll have one barium and one sulfate. Everything at equilibrium can't be zero, so these will both be increasing. So at equilibrium, 0.010 plus Y will be the amount of barium, and just Y will be the amount of sulfate. Now, when barium wasn't there before, I used X for both of these. It was 0 plus X, or just X and X. So X squared equals KSP, and we solve for X that way. Now, with these Ys here, which I'm showing to because we've added this common ion, we'll let this times this amount equal KSP and solve for Y that way. Okay. So you can let it equal 0.010 plus Y times Y, all right? This could be a quadratic. You're absolutely welcome to solve it that way. Here's your K. It would be Y squared plus 0.010Y minus KSP equals zero. But if you remember that in the pure water, the amount that it dissociated was 10 to the minus 5, and by adding barium, we predict it's gonna move to the left and be even smaller, I would have no problems in emitting this little plus Y. And the reason for that is just to keep me out of the world of the quadratic formula. It's not wrong to do quadratic formulas, absolutely, but it does take more time just to enter it in. So if you do that, if you ignore this little plus Y, then you have KSP equals 0.010 times Y, and you can solve for Y pretty easy. So if you divide both sides by 0.010, the solubility in the presence of the barium nitrate, 1.1 times 10 to the minus 8th. Anytime you make assumptions, you should think about if it's just legit or if you're being extra lazy. And trust me, on a Friday, I kind of feel that way. So if you rationalize, all right, this Y would be like this number, all right? And by sig figs, when you add, you have to cut it off at the largest doubtful digit. So this would be the thousandths, and this would be blah, 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 something even smaller, all right? So this number would be still 0.010. It isn't big enough to affect this parentheses value. And it also makes sense. We said that adding barium would make the solubility go down. 10 to the minus 8 is certainly smaller than 10 to the minus 5. Cool. So in the presence of the barium, our solubility went way down. And if you don't want, for example, a lot of sulfate running around, it probably does make some sense to put some barium in. It'll keep the amount of free ion smaller than it was before. Question? Okay. So in pure water, our barium sulfate, 10 to the minus 5. In the presence of barium, 10 to the minus 8. So again, we dropped it three orders of magnitude or so, 5 to 8. Roughly, all right. Woohoo! Le Chatelier's principle is followed. There's a guide in your companion that I wrote called the Solubility Guide, and I tried to do examples of some of these, plus some things we'll see here pretty soon and stuff. You might check it out and for more information on it. This is just kind of a fun video. Barium sulfate is a very white solid when it forms, but this is again one of these super high speed camera kind of things, and it's kind of fun to watch the reactions and stuff. The barium sulfate just kind of sits there. All right. What the? We'll be right back. Now, I've done some strange things in this class, I understand, and this is probably one of the weirder ones. Profat Toliaf, I find solubility, honestly, pretty boring. Alright, and it's really important, alright, but talking about KSBs and solubilities, ooh, solubility went down, common ion effect, woohoo! Anyway, on a Friday, May the 4th, as I said, day anyway, I feel even less inspired. So I try and bring this up just to shake it up a little bit. I do some off-campus kind of consulting, and I was sent this video one time, I'm like, oh, because solubility is kind of slow. Solubility is really important for science and the world in general. I'm not going to deny it, right? You want to keep the mercury out of your water, you've got to control solubility, all right? You want your solid to dissolve more, you want your solid to dissolve less. You have to use these rules. So it is important, but even my best teaching skills don't always make it super exciting, and I apologize. So hopefully this was a distraction.
In the test tube is an aqueous solution containing ions of silver, lead, and copper. When we add chloride ions, a precipitation occurs, producing solid silver chloride and solid lead chloride. The copper ions remain in solution, indicated by the blue color of the liquid, which is decanted. We add distilled water to the test tube and heat it. Lead chloride is soluble in hot water and returns to solution. We again decant the solution in the test tube, leaving solid silver chloride. To demonstrate that the decanted solution contains lead ions, we can add chromate ions, which cause the precipitation of lead chromate. The characteristic yellow color of the precipitate confirms the presence of lead. We have separated the three ions in the original solution from each other.
This video is an example of one of the two main ways that chemists make money, all right? And one of the ways is the chemists will take raw materials and turn them into more complex things, so plastics and metals and stuff, and that's huge. But the other one is really this one right here. When you go out and you dig a hole in Mother Nature's backyard, you don't find pure sodium chloride or ammonium nitrate or whatever, all right? You find mixtures of things. And chemists, also one of the ways they get paid a lot in identifying is also through separating out these substances. And this is an example of one way that you can use these KSPs. Yes, they're not super exciting, but it's kind of fun. And there are some colors in here anyway. All right, Profat back on. One way that you can use KSPs then to separate out some of these ions from each other. The last three labs we're going to do in Chem 223 are basically labs like this, where you're going to have a mixture of things and you want to separate it out and identify what's inside there. And it's kind of clever. So let's talk about this example. I'm going to show this video again because it's kind of important. We have a mixture, intentionally or unintentionally, which has three metal ions in it, copper, silver, and lead. And the goal of this experiment is to separate the copper from the silver from the lead, et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing this person did is they added some chloride. And chloride reacts readily with silver ions and lead 2 ions, but it doesn't react with copper 2 plus ions. If you remember from our cheesy Chem 221 rules we talked about on Wednesday, chloride, bromide, and iodide are usually AQ unless they're with a silver, lead, or that mercury ion. So in the presence of chloride, you readily get silver chloride and lead 2 chloride. You could also, though, now look at these numbers and predict that you would see a solid for these, because a K less than 1, even though these are different numbers, a K less than 1 means you're going to see a solid. So we don't have a KSP for copper 2 chloride. I don't think it exists because it's so water soluble. It's like sodium chloride, all right? But in this case, you add a chloride and solid AgCl and PbCl2 crash out, become a precipitate. And from there, you can decant, which means to pour the liquid off the solid, pour the liquid off, which is mostly the copper ions. Copper, by the way, has a really nice blue color, so that looks legit. But now you've got a test tube with white silver chloride and white lead 2 chloride. And the question is, how do you separate them out? And the next thing they did was they heated that white solid. Because, as you saw in the Le Chatelier's principal lab a few weeks ago, the lead to chloride dissolves in hot water, and it doesn't take too much to make that happen. Silver chloride does not dissolve as readily in hot water. It's much harder to get to dissolve. So they dissolved the lead to chloride. They again decanted the hot solution into a new beaker. And then this one should have had the silver ions as silver chloride, and this new one had lead 2 plus or PbCl2. But the last thing they did was pretty clever, I thought. Both AgCl and PbCl2 are white solids. You can't differentiate them visually. So what they did is they added chromate to the what they thought was the lead 2 chloride, the one that dissolved, and they decanted it. And PbCr04 is a really intense yellow color, and you'll see this in lab in a few weeks. But anyway, that's a way to identify and confirm that you have the lead there. Silver chromate makes kind of a red color when you have it. If this would have been me, I would have added some chromate to this one as well, and we should have seen a red Ag2CrO4, but that's okay. So as a chemist, this is cool. We separated out these three ions, all right? And is it 100% isolated? No. There's still gonna be silver and lead here. There's probably a little copper and silver over in this one, but many, 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 many orders of magnitude less. And in my world, that is a separation. So this one is basically been separated out, not 100%. Any questions on that? Okay, I'm gonna show this video again because it's kind of important, so bear with me.
In the test tube is an aqueous solution containing ions of silver, lead, and copper. When we add chloride ions, a precipitation occurs, producing solid silver chloride and solid lead chloride. The copper ions remain in solution, indicated by the blue color of the liquid, which is decanted. We add distilled water to the test tube and heat it. Lead chloride is soluble in hot water and returns to solution. We again decant the solution in the test tube, leaving solid silver chloride. To demonstrate that the decanted solution contains lead ions, we can add chromate ions, which cause the precipitation of lead chromate. The characteristic yellow color of the precipitate confirms the presence of lead. We have separated the three ions in the original solution from each other.
So again, we have a nice color separation. We know that that last liquid wasn't just water because the presence of the chromate made a yellow color, which is PbCr04 and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool. Any questions on that? All right. This is an example of using just silver 1 chromate, excuse me, or lead 2 chromate. Now, visually, if you had these test tubes in front of you, the PbCr04 was that yellow compound we just saw, and it's a very vibrant yellow. The Ag2CrO4 is kind of a red-brown, reddish kind of a color, you can see. But anyway, let's pretend that we have a solution, a test tube, and we have 0.020 molar silver ions and 0.020 molar lead 2 plus ions. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna very slowly add chromate. And we can add this in as small quantities as we want to, by the way. And we're gonna first, we'll see a red silver chromate and a yellow PbCr04. And this first question is, which one are we gonna see first, all right? Will we see the red Ag2CrO4, or will we see the yellow PbCr04? In this particular question, you can make right away a guess as to which one you're going to see first. Because K, remember, is nothing more than an equilibrium constant. And as K gets smaller, you will have more reactant. As K gets larger, you're going to have more product. So if you look at the PbCr04 and the Ag2Cr04, this number is quite a bit smaller, or order of magnitude or so, than this one is right here. So this is a kind of a quick and dirty I'm letting you in on. On these, you can usually guess which one is going to precipitate first by this smaller KSP. It's not really that simple. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. But I want to put that right on the board because more often than not, that works really well. So in this case, because this is a smaller K, we'll assume that the PbCr04 will precipitate out, and we'll predict then that the yellow color will appear before red. But that's not 100%, like we'll talk about in a second, but just kind of a FYI. Questions on that? All right. When you exceed this KSP threshold thing, that's when you're going to start seeing solid. And that's why I let you in on my little quick and dirty secret here that usually, all right, smaller K usually means first precipitate. Larger K would be the second one to precipitate. It's not always that way, but more often than not. It's kind of like crossover in Chem 221 when we did ions. Most of the time, crossover works really well, but once in a while, some stupid compound like TiO2 pops in. This is an example of that. Usually smaller K means first one to precipitate. Okay. What you need to do to really nail this down is you want to find the chromate that each of those ions requires to precipitate. Remember all of these expressions, KSP equals the ions. So for this one it would be silver squared times chromate. For this one it would be lead 2 plus times chromate. You've got the silver, you've got the lead. We're going to plug them into both of these and solve each of these for chromate. So for PbCr04, we'll take the KSP for the PbCr04, divide it by the lead, 0.020, the amount of chromate required to make PbCr04 crash out, 9.0 times 10 to the minus 13. If you do the same thing for silver, silver has a squared right there, so we'll take the KSP for the Ag2CrO4 and divide it by the silver ion squared, 2.3 times 10 to the minus 8. And if you look at these two numbers, all right, 10 to the minus 13th, quite a bit smaller than 10 to the minus 8th. So that means the amount of chromate needed to make yellow PbCr4 much less than the amount of chromate needed to make the Ag2CrO4. So we will definitely see, the yellow PbCr04 first. If we add our chromates in super small amounts, like if we got up to 8.0 times 10 to the minus 13th, we wouldn't see any. But at 9.0 10 to the minus 13th, we would. But it takes many orders of magnitude larger chromate to make the silver chromate come out. That's what this means. Any questions? Here's an example of another compound where we have both a sulfite and a sulfate, okay? Sulfite is SO3 and sulfate is SO4. And here are their respective KSPs. And it said that we're adding in solid calcium nitrate. The solid is just to make the moles per liter not go freaky on us, basically. And it says which one precipitates first. So again, if you have to guess, all right, and as most of the time this works, smaller KSP would be the one to precipitate out. So you can make the prediction that it would be the calcium sulfite, because 10 to the minus 8 is smaller than 10 to the minus 5. However, some of you in here will do it the correct way, which is better, I won't deny it, and you'll take the KSP and divide it by the corresponding ion. So for the sulfate, 0.10 is the amount of sulfite you have. This divided by this would give you the amount of calcium needed to make the precipitation begin. And for calcium sulfate, you would take this number and divide by the amount of sulfate you have to see the calcium there. And either way you do it, you should end up with calcium sulfite. 10 to the minus 5 divided by 0.30 is a lot bigger than 10 to the minus 5 divided by 0.1. All right, this is a 10 to the minus 7th, and this is 10 to the minus 4, I think, roughly. All right, so there's quite a bit of difference in those numbers. Questions? All right, so now that we know from the last one that the yellow PbCr04 is going to crash first, precipitate out. It, sometimes it's nice to know how much lead is left when the silver begins to precipitate. Now in the last example, all right, we calculated explicitly that the chromate required to make the red Ag2CrO4 was quite a bit larger than the chromate required to make the yellow pop out. If the goal is separating the lead from the silver, all right, the question becomes, how much lead 2 plus, how much of this 0.020 is left when the Ag2CrO4 begins to precipitate? We're trying to separate out these ions from each other. And once you have enough chromate to make this one precipitate, it forms that Ag or the PbCr4, it precipitates out. What we're basically saying here is how much chromate can we add where you have almost no silver chromate, you can decant the liquid off, and hopefully have a lot less lead than you started with. But how much less lead? All right? Lead in solution is usually more dangerous than lead as a solid. So we want to see how good our separation here is. Now this process is not difficult mathematically, but it can be a little weird at first. We're basically going to take the chromate from the silver chromate we used earlier and pop it back in here for the PbCrO4 equation and solve for lead. So it's like taking the more soluble chromate, putting it in the less soluble chromate, KSP, and solving for lead. So mathematically, again, it's not hard, it's just it's kind of weird sometimes, so just let me know. Chromate was 2.3 times 10 to the minus 8th moles per liter to begin the silver chromate precipitating. And we want to know how much of this 0.02 is left at that point, because as we form PbCrO4, this begins to go down, and we want to see how much farther it is down. So again, mathematically, we're going to take the KSP of the least less soluble compound, which is PbCrO4, 10 to the minus 14th, and we'll divide it by the chromate of the more soluble compound, all right, which was 2.3 times 10 to the minus 8th. And if you do that, you get this number out right here, 10 to the minus 7th. And this is a time where chemists can kind of pat themselves on the back, because we started with 10 to the minus 2, and it went down to less than 10 to the minus 6, almost 10 to the minus 7th. So this is dropping the lead concentration by many orders of magnitude. And if you want to separate these things out, that's pretty cool. So this is a way that we can say, oh yeah, cool, we're cool, I guess. We're dropping the lead concentration down to quite a bit of what it was. And the silver ion should still be at this point, 0.020. At 2.29 times 10 to the minus 8th moles per liter, we haven't formed any of the red compound, the red Ag2CrO4. At this point is when you begin to start thinking about the solid. So at this point, we've got now the lead down to quite a bit less than what it was. That's why I say we can pat ourselves on the back. No exciting stuff, I know. Anyway, questions? All right, let's stop here and let's talk about the midterm. So give me a second to shut all this stuff down. Okay, So in Chem 223, these are the point percentages, 90% is an A, 80% is a B, et cetera, et cetera. It was a 140-point exam, and the high score was an amazing 135. And several of you were right around that too, which was really cool. I was very, very pleased. Below, a little less than 135, and that's all we have to say about that. The average in this class, 99.3, all right? So this was an intense exam and stuff like that, definitely, no question about it. When you get your exam back, first of all, I separate them out by which lab section you're in. So like this is Tuesday morning, Tuesday afternoon, stuff like that. And I'll put them out different places and stuff so that you can see. When you get your exam back, on the back page of the first page will be your exam score. What I would do, though, is go straight to the back page, all right? And the number in the lower right-hand corner of the summary sheet is your percentage in the class as of this day. And I would definitely check that out. Now, this summary sheet has what I think are all of your grades, and I do encourage you to check them out. All right, I make mistakes. It's not intentional. I think about Star Wars too much or whatever. But check it out and make sure that it's good to go. If there's a lab missing, I'll circle it and stuff, and I totally encourage you to check that out and see what's going on. If you got 135 or if you got less than 135, knowing how you did on the exam and why you got the problems wrong is a good part of the thing to make you stronger. So I do encourage you to go over your exam and see what's happening. Now, what I like to do is, because there's a lot of you and only one of me, is I do encourage you to take it and go home or go to the library, whatever, and look it over. In less than 20 minutes, I'll have the exam key online. So if you go to our website and you go to quizzes and exams, you can look at the key, my answer key for it. If you look at number 7 and you're like, man, I have no idea what you're talking about, Russell, on Monday, I absolutely encourage you to come talk to me and we can go over the problems and stuff like that, no problem. That would be cool. As a way to encourage some of you to do this, as I said, about by 10:30, I'm hoping, I'm going to send an email to the MHChem email list, and it's going to have an extra credit thing you can do, an exam analysis, which is just a way to make you go and look at your exam and see which ones you got right, see which ones you got wrong. The exam analysis is extra credit. It's worth it, and that will be due not next week, but the week after, so at the time of problem set number 4. If you don't receive this email by like noon, email me directly, and I'll send it to you that way as well. Should be fine. Any questions on this kind of stuff? Okay. So then knowing that, down here by Melissa, if that's okay with you, I will put Tuesday morning stuff. I will put Tuesday afternoon stuff right here. And those of you on Wednesday, I will actually place it on this table right here. So have a great week. Oh, you will be in your regular lab. That's a good call. Yours will be in there. They're organized by last names.